Have you ever felt frustrated because you just couldn't find a lovely book to read? I can start to crave not just a good book, but a book that draws me in and evokes such a deep emotion that I can say, wow, that was a lovely book. Welcome, friends. This is Emmy B on Lovely Books Podcast, where it's my job to highlight the lovely books that keep you reading and connect you to the world. If you're new to Lovely Books, this podcast is more than just a best books podcast. It's about the reader's experience and takeaway. No book reviews, no analysis of literary content, just thoughts and personal anecdotes brought to our minds by the characters and subject matter that we love. That's what brings the book to life for you. I hope we give you something to think about, something to laugh about, and something lovely to read. So, in this episode, Whitney Flygar will highlight the book Maybe You Should Talk to Someone by Lori Gottlieb. It was published in April of 2019. So, a little bit about the author. She is a psychotherapist and a New York Times bestselling author of Maybe You Should Talk to Someone, which is being adapted to a TV series program.
Which will be awesome.
Yeah. In addition to her clinical practice, which she still has, she writes weekly for the Atlantic's Dear Therapist column, which actually recently became a podcast. I just saw something about episode 8. I don't know how many episodes she's into it, but they've kind of turned that into a podcast, which is cool, which is an advice column. And then she regularly contributes to the New York Times. A couple funny things. There's just a funny part in her book where she talks about being a little bit of a voyeur and voyeurism. And I really tried to stalk her on like Facebook and Instagram and social media. Oh, she's done a good job of getting herself hidden.
Oh,
because I wanted to like be able to share something more personal about her.
Uh-huh.
But her standard bio on everything is like very on Goodreads, on Twitter, on Instagram, on everything. Like she has the exact like verbatim. On her website, her bio is like word for word.
That's so funny because when she's talking about being being voyeuristic, mm-hmm. she's talking about stalking her ex-boyfriend online that way. And then her therapist too. She does it to her therapist.
Yes.
Oh, that's so funny. I love it.
So before we start, Whitney, welcome back.
Thank you.
You have... Is this your third time?
This is my third time.
Yay. I love having Whitney because she's so fun to talk to and easy to talk to. So... That makes for a fun conversation. So before we begin, I have to share, I just ask Whitney to share with us her background in mental health, which got switched around to what is your mental health background, which everybody has like on some, I think all adults, I mean, we all have history. We all have our defense mechanisms. We all have ways that we deal with stuff. But Whitney is actually a school psychologist and has a master's degree. So before we dive in, why don't you just kind of give us a little bit of your educational background?
Okay. First of all, I have to say when you said that, it made me so happy. I was like, that is the perfect thing to say for this book because this book is written from what's your background in mental health and what's your mental health background perspective. And it's
totally.
Wonderful.
It's so fun.
As far as my background in mental health,
okay.
you said, I'm a licensed school psychologist and I have a master's degree in educational psychology and I teach a couple psychology courses for the University of Utah.
So I tried with this book to kind of look at a couple different interviews that she'd done, and I found that she did a TED Talk in September of 2019. Have you watched that?
No, I haven't.
It was so funny because this book was released in April. The TED Talk was in September of that same year. And when I was listening to it, I have the book so fresh in my mind because I just finished reading it. And me and my sisters, we have this joke where we always talk about all the things that I learned from the books I never read. Because when somebody reads a really great, like, helpful nonfiction book, as women, like, we talk about it. Mm-hmm. Like, oh, I just read this. And did you know this about raising children? Did you know this about mental health? Did you know this about watching TV? About, you know, all these different things. And we always share it. And I felt like she, her TED Talk just was so exactly what her book is that I definitely think if you're not sure if you want to read this book or, you know, if you're like, I have it on my list, but I'm not totally like ready to read it yet, you should listen to her TED Talk because that was fun. What made you decide to read it?
Nikki.
Oh,
Actually, yeah. So for those of you listening, a girl from our
book club
told me last month, 2 months ago, she was like, hey, I'm reading this book. I think you'll love it. And I was like, okay. And then I just put it on my Overdrive wait list and it came up and I was like, okay, we'll do this right now. Because, you know, when a book comes up the library, yeah. you're like, I read this now, right? You know, yeah, this is available now.
Everything else goes to the side.
Yeah, everything else. The books I own can wait because right. this one's going away in 3 weeks.
Can you kind of give us a synopsis of what the story is, like how the layout is? I know you can't tell the whole story, but what the layout is.
Yes. So this is the story. So Lori, and like you said, this is a memoir. So this is her true life story. But she started out working in TV production, thought that was her job that she wanted to do. She was doing great in it. And then she was actually working on a show that... it was like a.
It was ER.
Was it ER?
It was ER.
Oh my gosh, that's what it was. I was like, what was the show? Yeah, so, you know, medical drama, and she went and started like shadowing an ER room so that she could write these scripts, and then she fell in love with the ER. Long story short, ends up going to med school, and almost done with med school, she's like, you know what? This is not what I thought it was going to be. And I don't want to spend 15 minutes with a patient and then be done. I want to be involved in their stories and everything. Mm-hmm. And her advisor in medical school was like, you know what? You should be a therapist. So she stopped going to med school. She went to grad school and is now this amazing therapist who's done really well. And
which I think, first of all, is really inspiring because she didn't switch careers. And this is like a big jump from television to medicine to psychotherapist. That's kind of like a broad jump, but I was really actually inspired by the fact that she would do so much education and be so successful in a job, but be able to recognize, like, even though I'm good at this and I'm experienced success in this field, like, it's not for me.
Yeah.
And be brave enough to start over.
She's obviously a very, very talented person. She was in med school and I think Stanford, you know, so
yeah,
I mean, that's not an easy thing to be like, no. I'm going to do a complete 180 and go to an Ivy League med school.
Right.
And then drop out right before graduating, you know, not because she wasn't able to hack it, but because it wasn't her passion.
Totally. Totally. So that is really inspiring. I like that. So then she goes on and she talks about patients. Mm-hmm. So we're kind of going, are we going chapter to chapter? Kind of?
A little bit. It switches back and forth because it follows the story. She chooses a couple patients and follows their stories. But then at the same time, at the beginning of the book, her boyfriend leaves her really out of the blue. And they'd been together for years and they were, you know, planning on getting married. And then he drops this bomb on her and leaves. And so she is having a hard time coping with that. So she goes into therapy. So she talks about these patients that she's seeing, these three patients that it follows. And then it talks about her experience with her therapist and of being on the other side of the couch and the things that she learns from being the patient. So it very much follows like what she's learned being a therapist and then what she's learned being the patient. And I absolutely loved it. I think probably the thing that I loved most about this book is, you know, like you said, there's so many self-help and everything books out there. I'm actually reading another one right now about adult attachment styles.
Okay.
And talking about like the things you learn from the books you've never know, right? You've never read. Yeah. So Stephen has not read it. I'm not making him read it. Sometimes I make him read the book, but this one I'm not making him read, but he knows enough about it to already be cracking jokes about our kid's teacher having anxious, you know, attachment style. So, but most books like that, I feel like are written from kind of an academic perspective, trying to be palatable. Mm-hmm. And she's not. I feel like hers was so real. And so, this is me and my experience. This is the research that supports these things. Mm-hmm. But this is just the raw me.
Yeah. And the fact that she ends up in therapy, which is so funny. So she's successful career, She has all of these things on her resume, and she's not in therapy because of the death of a loved one. She's not in therapy because she has an addiction. Mm-hmm. She is in therapy because her boyfriend broke up with her.
Yeah.
So first off, that is so humanizing.
Mm-hmm.
Because that's something that's so real, but it's one of those, shame-inducing things where it's like, I had to go to therapy because I couldn't get over my ex-boyfriend. Yeah. You know what I mean? So I love that she connects.
A level that we would usually shame.
Yeah.
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 You know, she says something great about that in the book. But she says that you can't compare suffering. That suffering is suffering, and that it's not like it's not a linear thing, and you can't say, well, my suffering is bigger than your suffering. That mm-hmm. suffering is in itself suffering.
Right.
And I love that you said that she went, you know, for this thing that we'd usually be like, you went because of that? Seems like such a small thing. Just get over it. Pull yourself up. Over, let's go, right? You know?
You went to medical school.
Yeah, exactly. You've done more things. Come on. Right. So much of this book does that, is that we have these shoulds in our life, in our minds of, well, I shouldn't be upset about that.
Mm-hmm.
And I should be able to get over this. And we're holding ourselves so often to these really subjective standards that don't reflect what's going on with us internally. And I love that she writes this book from this perspective of saying, no, I'm hurting and I don't need anyone else's validation to go seek help for my hurting.
Right. Yeah, I love that. The other thing along those lines that I love that she does is, as she's seeing her therapist, Wendell, what a name, what a great name, Wendell. There are moments during her therapy where she's like, I know what you're trying to do, and it is not going to work. I'm going to sit here. Because she can hear what the therapist is saying, and from knowing what it's like to be on the side of, you know, being the therapist, she knows what he's trying to do, but she is just like, I am going to be miserable right now, and you are not going to stop me. But it gives her a new sense of empathy in her mm-hmm. own sessions with her patients, which I love.
Mm-hmm. You know what I found to be so interesting about that too, is that when we're taught to sit with people in these situations and you go through training to do these kind of things, you learn to tell people or to talk to people in a way of like, we're not going to change other people in here. You're going to learn what's within your control and what you can do and how you can interact with other people. Mm-hmm. But we're not here to, you know, to talk about how we can make other people change, because that's beyond the scope of what we can do here.
Right.
But she goes to therapy wanting to be validated, because I won't use the words that she uses in it because they're a little explicit, but it was hilarious when she said them. She goes to therapy wanting validation that her boyfriend's a complete butt.
Yeah.
You know, because of what he did. And she's not wrong.
No.
But that's not what's going to help her.
Right.
And when her therapist tells her, you know, calls her out on that of like, you know,
that
this isn't what you're here for or shouldn't be here for, and that's not what we're going to do, she's upset about it.
Right.
And so I thought that that was something else that was so humanizing to me too, is that she's the professional and she knows all these things, but it still doesn't make her perfect.
Right.
And in the coming to understand that, I liked that in our day-to-day life too, because it's like, yeah, there's a lot of things you know better, but just because you know, it's maybe okay if you don't act that way all the time, because we're all a work in progress and we're all learning.
Totally. Well, then let me ask you this. We all have friends that we talk to when we're struggling, and like our people that we go to when we want to complain or when we're frustrated. So in this book, she kind of talks, and not extensively outright, but I think there's a lot of layers to this idea that the soothing, like the people who love us, the soothing way in which they interact with us is often not helpful. Right?
She has a quote where she talks about idiot compassion.
Yes!
Is that what you're going to?
Yes.
Yes. I loved that. In fact, you know what? This is a quote that's worth reading. So she says, above all, I didn't want to fall into the trap that Buddhists call idiot compassion, an apt phrase given John's worldview. John is one of her patients that she's seeing who thinks everyone around him's an idiot. Funny enough, it's never his fault. It's always someone else's fault. In idiot compassion, you avoid rocking the boat to spare people's feelings, even though the boat needs rocking and your compassion ends up being more harmful than your honesty. People do this with teenagers, spouses, addicts, even themselves. It is the opposite of wise compassion, which means caring about the person, but also giving him or her a loving truth bomb when needed.
Loving truth bomb. I love that phrase. That.
I know. Isn't that great?
But that's a hard thing. Like, I'm not a loving truth bomb giver. Mm-mm. That's really hard for me. Mm-hmm. In, I think, all my relationships with my friends, with my spouse, even with my kids, like, my husband's pretty good at those loving truth bombs, but I'm a sugarcoater. Uh-huh. And so, you know, if the people around me only ever had access to me, then they wouldn't get those.
It's hard.
Which is funny because I don't like to receive them either.
You know what? I actually gave someone a loving truth bomb once in the way that I thought was, like, as compassionate mm-hmm. as I could make it. And it changed our relationship for the worst.
Yeah.
And I fear that now.
So there are people who are therapy lovers. Uh-huh. And there are people who just straight up say no. And it's a pretty broad divide.
Yeah.
There are not a whole lot of people in the middle.
Yeah, there's not a lot of people who are lukewarm on therapy.
No. People are either like, yes, I'm a yeser. I love therapy. I'm a huge advocate. I will give recommendations. I will tell you who to go to. I will tell you my experience. I will give you the name.
And that's me. And I know that's you too.
Yes. Yeah. I just love that. Mm-hmm. So, and I'm a huge advocate since my early 20s was when I first started using a therapist. And when my husband and I got married, he's actually the one who suggested that we see a therapist every 6 months, like going to the dentist. You don't want cavities. You go to the dentist every 6 months. You don't want to get divorced. You go to a therapist every 6 months.
I think that is the most brilliant idea. I love it so much.
It's brilliant. But there is a broad divide between people who want it and people who don't. Mm-hmm. I read an interview by Lori, and one thing that she said that I really liked, the question was posed to her, what is the purpose of therapy? And her response to that was, it's our job as a therapist to allow our patients, to give them a mirror where they can look at themselves in a compassionate way.
You know, what's really interesting about that. So, a famous psychotherapist, Carl Rogers, who, if you watch videos of him, was just the kindest, most loving, you know, like super nice to be around person you'll ever come across. He said that people need three things to make positive change in their life. And one of them is unconditional positive regard. Hmm. That is, if as a therapist, if you could sit with someone and give them unconditional positive regard, regardless of what they're telling you, that is going to facilitate change.
Okay.
That instead of actually sitting there and telling someone like, well, that's pretty horrible what you did, you know, maybe you should stop that.
Yeah.
But rather, you know, just being able to sit there and be like, you are worthwhile as a person, regardless of the things that you've done, and you can make these positive changes because you are of worth.
Yeah.
That is enough to facilitate change in people. At the very beginning, she's seeing this patient, the John one who was just mentioned in this quote, and he's an awful person at first. And he's just so rude and so calloused and so myopic. Well, and
she even has like a little mantra that she says at one point half where she's just like, half
compassion. She's sitting there on her couch.
Yeah.
You know, and in her mind, she's just like, have compassion on this man. And I got to tell you, by the end, I loved John.
Oh, yeah.
And I think, and obviously, like, I'm able to love John because she loved him and was able to write about him in this light. But you hear about the suffering that John went through and why he's acting the way that he did. And you're like, oh, man.
Right?
Just, you need a cuddle.
Well, and that's a perfect segue into this idea of our self-narrative. Mm-hmm. That in order to make changes, we have to change our self-narrative. And Lori says in this book, she says that we are mostly unreliable narrators.
Oh, yeah, totally.
And so talk a little bit about what that means. Like, what is that? What does it mean to be an unreliable narrator?
That if you were to, if someone was to show you the film of your life, it'd probably be wildly different than your telling of your life. And your telling of your life changes depending on where you are in your life too. So a lot of this goes back to memory. We have this idea that memory is recorded and that it's objective, but it's not. Memory is constructed. And, you know, our memories change depending even on how we feel about them at the time. So, for example, if I have a happy memory of, let's say, someone I've dated in the past, okay? Mm-hmm. If there's a happy memory there, but then we go through a really nasty breakup, so now when I think of that person, I have kind of like this taint in my mind towards them. Mm-hmm. That taint can follow that memory. Every time I bring that memory up, it can be tainted by that, you know, negativity that I have of that person. Mm-hmm. Because every time we access our memories, we change them. And that's actually one of the problems with depression is that when someone's in a really deep depressive episode, even when they think about happy times in their life, they decrease the potency of that happiness because of where they are then in their life. Mm-hmm. And it can be really difficult. In the book, she says, "We can't have change without loss, which is why so often people say that they want to change but nonetheless stay exactly the same." Mm-hmm. And I think that, you know, not only does that talk to what we were just talking about, but also like this idea of being an unreliable narrator. Mm-hmm. Sometimes we look at where we want to be also and make that more part of the narration than what we've actually accomplished. Mm-hmm. We do that good and bad. We can do that to kind of uplift ourselves. We can also do that to drag ourselves down. Once mm-hmm. again, just depending on where we are.
Yeah. And who we're talking to.
And who we're talking to. Exactly.
Right. And depending on what image we want to portray for the person sitting across from us, we change the light that the story casts one way or another.
Oh my gosh.
We're sharing.
I love that we're talking about this right now, actually, because so one of the classes I teach for the University of Utah is general psychology, uh-huh. and it's a Thursday night. I taught tonight before mm-hmm. this, why we're meeting late, and we talked about social psych tonight, so we're, you know, talking about these different social pressures and how we like to portray ourselves.
Yeah.
There's also a bit of social pressure from within. We like to be consistent with ourselves.
Yeah.
And we'll change our narrative and we'll change our story to make sure that we're consistent with how we want to be or how we've been in the past.
Right.
Or we'll change our past to make it consistent with the future.
Oh.
Yeah.
That's interesting.
And then people call you out on it and you experience this feeling of cognitive dissonance, which is really uncomfortable. And you just, you know, life is hard.
If people are all going to therapy and wanting to be happier, they don't necessarily come out happier, but they, from my experience, it's about coming out with more acceptance and more self-awareness. Would you agree with that?
Absolutely. You know, it was really interesting. The New York Times actually just published an article about happiness and how looking at happiness, especially over this last year with the pandemic. Mm-hmm. And it was a great title. It was something like Everything You Know About Happiness Is Wrong or something like
that. I think I saw that actually.
Did you see that? Yeah. And what they found is, so there's all these things that we think will make us happy, that money will make us happy, that, you know, time will make us happy. All these things will make us happy. And come to find out, we have more of those things that should make us happy now than we ever have. But happiness in the U.S. has actually decreased. Mm-hmm. And what they found is that happiness really does come from not a better circumstance, but a better view of your current circumstance. And that happiness, almost like memory, is kind of a construct. Like you construct your own happiness out of the things that you accepting and being okay with and being grateful for the things that you have currently.
Yeah.
I look at all the ones that she talked about, and I would say that they are happier. Mm-hmm. But sometimes we don't recognize.
Yeah, but it's not happier like in the way.
It's not what they set out thinking would be.
Yeah.
So they all go to therapy thinking, this is my goal in therapy, and this is what I want, and this is what will make me happy.
Yeah.
And none of them get that.
Yeah.
But I think that at the end, all of them feel happier.
Yeah. Yeah. I think you're right.
You know, there's something else great that she says in the book about we can look at where we are in our lives and look at the good that's in them, that we're more likely to find happiness than if we chase this maybe unattainable idea of what I need to be happy.
Yeah, yeah. There's people who are listening who are like on the verge of like, I'm managing something difficult myself. I don't know if I need to see somebody for this. I'm not, I mean, where's the line, would you say, for people?
Well,
like at what point would you say like you absolutely need to be in therapy? And like, at what point would you say like, this would be a good time to consider it? Or
so if you have something that's inhibiting your ability to function, you should absolutely be in therapy. If you have something that is holding you back from living in the fullest expression that you want to live, go see someone. If you have anxiety that you're managing and you're holding the lid on and you're fine, but that, you know, stresses you out every day and is hard for you and you're functioning and you're okay, but you're not necessarily happy, go see someone. I mean, why not?
Right? Why not?
The thing I loved about this book is that there is this false dichotomy of like people who have problems and people who don't.
Yeah.
It's like, no, we all have problems. And I think that that's why everyone would benefit from going to therapy. Yeah. But I have I have a lot of insight into my self-destructive tendencies.
Right.
But doesn't mean they stop.
Right?
Yeah.
Yeah. So it's great to be able to go and number one, I like the idea of being accountable to somebody who's outside of my social circle. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. The other thing is that it's really, really easy for you to forgive your parents. Mm-hmm. It's really hard for your partner to forgive your parents after they've heard something horrible. It's really, really, really easy for you to forgive a best friend, but it is very, very hard for your sibling to forgive your best friend who was a jerk to you.
Well, because they're not part of the repair process.
Yeah.
Because you'll go and you'll grouch about the bad thing that happened. And, you know, and so that's what they're left with. So it's like you're inviting this person into your relationship that's going to be there for the bad part, and then they're not going to be there for, like, the makeup process.
Yeah.
So they're left with just the bad part.
Right. And so sometimes I don't think it's fair to not have a therapist.
Oh, my gosh. I love having a therapist.
It's the best.
I'm a big fan.
It's totally the best. So what do you think in this book she did that was unique? That really made this sort of stand out? Was it just like the perspective? I've never seen a book on this, on the idea of therapy and going through therapy and why we need therapy and information about therapy written from this perspective. I just thought it was so brilliant to have a psychoanalyst sit down with her psychoanalyst.
Totally.
And tell the tale from both sides.
Yeah. And I think for me, what it was her willing to just be so vulnerable and come out and, you know, come out of the ivory tower and be this person, you know, this valuable, not knowing everything person. Because when we go to therapy too, we put so much trust in our therapist and we think that they have all the answers. Mm-hmm. And I loved her being able to say, you know what? I don't have all the answers. This is me and my vulnerable side too. Mm-hmm. I think about, there's a classic book on therapy by a psychiatrist whose last name is Yalom called The Gift of Therapy. And it's a great book talking about how important and wonderful therapy can be. But it's very much from the all-knowing therapist professional perspective. And there's nothing wrong with that. But having her talk about it in the very personal, raw, I'm going through this too experience takes her down off of the like therapist pedestal and puts her equal with us.
Yeah.
And I loved that because it changes the power dynamic of I am the therapist and you are the patient and I'm here to help heal you.
Yeah.
To I'm a person too and I can help you and let's go on this journey together. And it was, I feel like it's so much more relatable.
Definitely.
You know, it's interesting. A minute ago, we talked about Carl Rogers and his ideas that, like, the things that you need for an effective therapeutic environment. And one of them is that unconditional positive regard. Another is, like, honest, authentic emotion, that you are sitting there being your honest self with people. Because otherwise, they'll see it. I mean, we know when someone's not being real.
Yeah.
And in order to be real there yourself and doing this therapeutic work, you need a therapist who's willing to sit there and be real with you.
Yeah.
And I feel like that was her.
Yeah, definitely.
I felt that way reading the book.
Totally. Totally. And her, you guys got to watch her TED Talk. It was great. Is there anything else that you loved about this that you wanted to share?
It's funny.
It's so funny.
It's so funny. Okay, as far, like, we're talking about really deep, like, you know, therapy and making changes in your life that are hard and finding your layers and all those things.
Oh, it's so funny.
And that's great. But on top of that, it's just a good read.
It is.
Like, it was just a fun read.
It's a fun read. The perspectives keep you on your toes. Do you have another book that you want to recommend to people that you've read recently that you love?
Okay. For all of you listeners, Anna Karenina is worth it. It's big. It's long. There's some drolling passages about farming, but holy cow, this book has everything. Like, forget watching soap operas. Like, Anna Karenina's got it all in the deep dive, and it's just awesome. I love it.
And I love a good plug for the classics, because there's so many great books right now, but those classics need not be overlooked.
Do you know the interesting thing is, I feel like modern novels are different. They're written at a much quicker pace. But sometimes I just want to get into something and just get into it.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's why I keep reading classics. Because there's some writers, like John Steinbeck is like this in the book East of Eden. East of Eden's thick. But, oh my gosh, it is such a crazy...
It's a crazy book.
Oh, there's...
Yeah, there's so much.
Murder, theft, sleeping with your husband's brother. It's all there. Yeah. Like, it's crazy.
Yeah.
But it's also just written in such a way where I'm like, you can narrate the ants walking across my kitchen.
Oh, yeah. I would read it. The writing's beautiful.
It's so good.
And I felt that way about A Gentleman in Moscow. Did you ever read that one?
I did, yes.
I felt that way about that one. It was like, just don't read this book for the plot, because it's slow. There isn't really one. What happens in that book? I don't really know. But the writing is beautiful.
Do you know what? There is a plot to that book, but it's in the first 20 and last 20 pages.
I know, right?
Yeah, and then the, like... 500 pages in between.
They're just beautiful.
They're so pretty.
The writing is just really beautiful. So, well, I'm glad that you did this with me today.
Thank you so much for having me on. I always just love doing this.
Thanks for joining us this week. If you like what you heard today, please remember to comment, like, subscribe, leave a rating, share this podcast with your family and friends. I hope you guys have a great week reading, and that you'll join us again next week when we highlight another lovely book.